So this is just a one-off, actually. So it's not Jonah. It's not anything like that. I do hope that I have a marker that works. This one should be dried out because it was open. Nope, looks good. All right, so we're just gonna focus on something that pertains to Easter and to the events of that final week that's recorded for us in all four Gospels. Different ways in each of the Gospels. Some events occur in one that don't occur in the others, but we're going to try to pull all that together, pull all the threads together. And the way I want to do this is actually by starting, so you're not going to be off the hook, even though you're on camera. It's you just have to ignore that. I want to start by kind of asking you how much you think you can fill in. So let's do it this way. This is Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and then Sunday again. And what I want to do is to go through and see, just from memory, just from your own thinking through, hopefully maybe even thinking it through, particularly this week, what events recorded for us in the Gospels take place. I want us to start to think through the sequence and the reason for the sequence of the events that are recorded for us in the Gospels that happened during this final week of Jesus' earthly ministry prior to the resurrection. So what you'll find, just to preface this once more before I put you on the spot and we kind of start going through days, in the Gospels, for instance, take the Gospel of John. In the Gospel of John, it records about 3 weeks. If you added up all the events and all the days that are mentioned in John's Gospel, it's about 3 weeks. Now, it's 3 weeks, two of which are spread out over about 3 years, and the other is the final week. So it gives you a sense of the proportions. The other Gospels are similar in that sense. There's not a lot recorded in each of the Gospels if you think about it. We have plenty of information, plenty of, you know, all that we need. I don't mean it that way. I don't mean we're given insufficient information. But what I mean is, when you actually add it up, it's not like a full and comprehensive biography of the teaching and life of Jesus. It's very, each Gospel is very selective. And that selectivity makes us say, all right, I want to pay careful attention to figure out why these things were selected and not others. John, at the end of his Gospel, actually says this. He says, I suppose if everything were written down that Jesus did and taught, even all the books in the world couldn't contain it. But these things are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God. So John basically says, there's a lot out there I selected because I had a particular purpose. Luke says much the same thing at the beginning of the Gospel. Luke says, I talked to all these eyewitnesses. I spoke to people who were there. I gave detailed study to this. But what I wanted to do is present for you an organized account. Probably Luke is saying a chronologically organized account, so that Theophilus, you may know of all the details of the things that you've already believed. So both Luke and John do this really explicitly. Matthew and Mark, a little bit less explicitly, but no less intentionally, say, I'm selecting. All right? So with that in mind, out of all that they select, that final week is about half of the Gospels. And so I want us to just zero in on that final week and say, what happens each day? And what's the significance of what happens each day? Now, some of these I think you can get. So you need to, we've got some new people. It's time to talk. All right? Just this 1 week. So let's start here. This is the Sunday prior to the crucifixion. So you know, Good Friday, all right, just to orient yourself. So we're starting prior to that, the Sunday prior to it, the first day of the week prior to it. What takes place? What do you remember? Go ahead.
The triumphal entry into Jerusalem.
Good. So that was it's good to be the first person out of the gate for a lot of reasons. It socially breaks down barriers, but also if you know there's one thing you know, you get to say it. And the one thing that you should know is that triumphal entry, right? We think about it in terms of Palm Sunday, because at the triumphal entry they were waving these palm branches. And so, what else can you tell us about what happened? Just unpack that for us. You're right.
Yeah. Before that, there was prophecy fulfilled by this, Jesus telling the disciples to go and fetch the donkey and her colt. So he would ride into Jerusalem on the foal of a donkey, and people lay palm branches and clothing on the road in front of him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good. So that covers a lot of it. So here's what we have recorded for us in the Gospels, and this is, if you want to write down these references, we're talking Matthew 21, Mark 11, Luke 19, the end of Luke 19, starting in verse 28, and John 12. So it's in all four Gospels. All of these events I'm about to mention are in all four Gospels. First, it starts out with Jesus at the Mount of Olives, so just outside Jerusalem, and then he sends two of his disciples, right? He sends them to secure a donkey and a colt. They secure those. He then makes his quote-unquote triumphal entry. It's not very far, Mount of Olives. If you go to Jerusalem now, it's just right there. I mean, it's kind of just outside the city walls, and those particular, that side of walls is pretty similar to the way it was in Jesus' day. So the Mount of Olives is just outside. Jesus makes his triumphal entry, and then on the way in, now here's what you didn't include. On the way in, all four gospel writers include this. On the way in, Jesus also stops after he's met with this crowd of people and they've said what they've said. He stops, and it says that he wept over Jerusalem. As he's coming in, he weeps over Jerusalem. And then there are a couple other things that happen that we don't usually remember. So he weeps over Jerusalem, and remember what he says when he weeps over Jerusalem. He weeps because he says, you know, Jerusalem is, I'm paraphrasing here, but Jerusalem's always killed the prophets in the end, and that he's longed to gather the people of Jerusalem, but he knows that this is actually going to be a time of rejection. And then, but interestingly enough, John records something in John 12 that happens after he comes into Jerusalem. And this is all very important because, so Jesus weeps over Jerusalem. The Jewish people, as he comes in, seem to exalt him. Hosanna, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. They call him the Son of David. But then it says some Greeks, some non-Jews, actually are looking for Jesus during this time, and they find him. And he ends up having a little bit of a dialogue with them. Then he goes into the temple area of Jerusalem. So he's making his way through the city. He goes into the temple area. And then they go and return to Bethany, and then he instructs his disciples to secure an upper room for later in the week when they're going to celebrate the Passover. So starts outside of Jerusalem, just outside, goes in, triumphal entry, weeps, gets into Jerusalem, Greeks seek him out, then he goes into the temple area and leaves the temple, goes to Bethany, which is just couple of miles away, it's walkable, and it's at that time he says to his disciples, find a place in Jerusalem, because we're coming back here for the Passover meal. That's day one. And again, that's, I gave you some of the references, but some of the ones that I didn't give you, the Greeks seeking Jesus, that's just recorded in John's Gospel. That's in John 12. And then the going into the temple and returning to Bethany, both Mark and Matthew record that. And then the instructions for the Passover meal, Matthew, Mark, and Luke record that for us. And we can come back and look at a few of these, but I'm just trying to get the overall flow of things. And, you know, if we were just pause and say, what's kind of the takeaway that we get just from this day one? What are some of the things that are emphasized? Well, one of the things that's emphasized is Jesus' fulfillment of prophecy. There's a lot. Again, we didn't read those texts, but there's a lot in those texts about, you know, this was to fulfill that which was spoken. There's a lot of Old Testament references that are mentioned directly. So certainly fulfillment of prophecy, but also there's this note of rejection. And rejection, Jesus has full knowledge that he's going to be rejected by his people. And yet, interestingly enough, those people who seem most receptive to Jesus at this time are these Gentiles who come in and kind of looking for him and want to ask him some questions. And so that rejection by his own people, but reception by the Gentiles is already there just on that first day. All right, let's talk about Monday. Does anyone want to just think about anything that happens on that day that's recorded for us in the Gospels? Anyone know of anything? Go ahead.
Cleansing the temple.
Exactly. Cleansing the temple. Yes, that's the big event. That's kind of the showstopper. That's the thing that gets all the attention. Now, there's a couple other things that happen. Remember where he ended on Sunday night, which is in Bethany. And so on Monday morning, they leave Bethany. The gospel writers tell us they return to Jerusalem. And Jesus actually does something along the way. Remember as he entered Jerusalem before, he wept over Jerusalem? He does something similar here. What he does is he stops at a fig tree and curses the fig tree. And says, you know, you're not going to bear fruit. It's kind of an odd thing. Because remember, the gospel writers leave so much out, but they keep this in. Why do they keep it in? Well, it's because it's, in a sense, what Jesus is doing is he's pronouncing a curse on these people who really should have received him, but they didn't receive him. That's recorded for us in Matthew 21 and in Mark 11. Then he cleanses the temple. That's recorded for us in three Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And that, you know, from a human perspective, okay, just from the perspective of if you were an unbelieving historian saying, what went wrong? How did we go from, you know, day one where they're saying Hosanna and even Gentiles are coming to him to day, you know, to Friday where they're saying crucify him? What happened between that time? The big, humanly speaking, I mean, obviously there's spiritual dynamics at work. There's prophecy being fulfilled. We know all that. But from a just standard, like on the ground, taking spiritual things out of it, what happens? This is kind of what happens. He goes into the temple and cleanses the temple. This is so key that I think it's worth just looking at very briefly. Even though it's not a ton, there's not a ton of space given to it. All the three of the gospel writers say more or less the same thing. Let's look at Luke's account, Luke 19. Again, Luke is probably the most chronologically concerned with of all of them. And so here we get, he entered the temple, verse 45 of Luke 19, and began to drive out those who sold. So they're buying and selling in the courts of the temple, and saying to them, it is written, my house shall be a house of prayer, but you've made it a den of robbers. And he was teaching daily in the temple, and the chief priests and the scribes and the principal men of the people were seeking to destroy him, but they did not find anything they could do, for all the people were hanging on his words. So what you know is that when Jesus goes in and cleanses the temple, overthrows all these money changers' tables. He does this twice, actually, but this is right at the end. And when he does this again, the Jewish leaders and all the kind of prominent people in Jerusalem who had a stake in what was happening in the temple start to say, we've got to do something about this guy. This has gone on too long. And probably in their minds, if you're thinking kind of from a business standpoint, probably in their minds, part of what they're saying is, this cannot happen during Passover week. We could tolerate it, and it was annoying at some other time. But this is the most important day or week on our calendar. All these people are coming in. All these people are coming in just to worship at the temple. We can't have the temple disrupted. He disrupted the temple on Passover week. And so we've got to do something. And as they try to figure this out, Luke tells us, they realize it's difficult because there's nothing that he's actually done wrong, and the people are still on his side. So then what's the rest of the week for the chief priests? The rest of the week for the chief priests and the chief Jewish rulers in Jerusalem is basically, let's find a way to drive a wedge between him and the people. If we can do that, we already know what we want, which is we want him gone. And if we can find a way to get the people on our side, even briefly, then we'll take care of this once and for all. So they're already there in their minds. They know that the people aren't with them. So, but they've got opportunities, right? Because in the next 1, 2, 3 days, all the people are kind of a captive audience. So it's kind of, the impression you get on Monday is, it's kind of like the chief priests are saying to themselves, all right, we have 3 days to talk the people out of their affection for Jesus and get them where we are already, which is, he's a disruptor. We can't have him around anymore. And that's how they're thinking from this point forward. So every other day is kind of, there's this cloud that overshadows it that is the reaction of the people to the cleansing of the temple. Now, the only other thing we know about this day, beyond the cleansing of the temple, is that then at the end of the day, Jesus and the disciples do what they did the day before, which is they go back to Bethany and spend the night there. So he's kind of coming in and out of Jerusalem. Could be a lot of reasons for this. He had friends in Bethany. We know that. And you know, Jerusalem was packed. And so there is a little bit of a sense of familiarity in Bethlehem or in Bethany. And also probably just a place to stay. Because Jerusalem was going to be very difficult to... It would be very difficult to find a place to stay in Jerusalem during Passover week. And, you know, again, remember, that's why Jesus is so interested in saying to his disciples, find an upper room, because we do at least, we need to have the Passover meal in Jerusalem. But we don't need to stay in Jerusalem. We'll stay out of town and in Bethany. So that's the only other thing we know. And we only know that from Mark 11, where Mark says, after this all happened, then they went back to Bethany for the night. And you know, it is a reminder, at the beginning of John's Gospel, John has these words in the prologue. It says, he came to his own, and his own did not receive him. And you kind of, that's just a summary statement from John, but you kind of see it played out in front of you in this section, where he comes into the temple, he quotes from the Old Testament, he does a good thing for the temple. It's not, it's disruptive, but it's disruptive in a good way. And yet, they want nothing to do with him at this point. He's just simply getting in the way. All right. It's going to be harder these next couple days. Maybe you're not so sure what happens on Tuesday, Wednesday. We'll get there. There's not a ton that happens on Tuesday that we know about, but there are some things that are basically picked up on from the previous days. So, Tuesday. Can anyone tell me anything that we know from the Gospels that happens on Tuesday? Russ, you're shaking your head. You've got nothing on Tuesday. Well, there are a couple things that happen. Anyone else have an idea, Sarah? Oh, you look like you were right there.
Sorry.
Okay. You and Ross had like the opposite looks on your face. Like he's shaking his head and you were ready. Tuesday? Anyone? This one's really difficult. This is probably the hardest of all the days of the week. There's really only two things we know from the Gospels. I'm sure lots of things happen, right? The Gospels are selective. We know that. And we still know more about this Tuesday than we know about a lot of Tuesdays in Jesus' life. But there's only two things that I think we could say for sure.
What day is the Olivet Discourse? Is that Tuesday?
So Jesus actually speaks on the Mount of Olives in a couple of occasions. He speaks on the Mount of Olives he starts on the Mount of Olives on Sunday, and then he comes back to the Mount of Olives later on. But the Olivet Discourse itself is, unless it happens, earlier in the week, we don't know that it happens on Tuesday. It's not recorded for us as happening on Tuesday. Any other?
Is it the fig tree?
Yeah. What happens with the fig tree?
It withered.
That's exactly right. So it withers. And so remember how Jesus went in, cursed the fig tree? But we don't know what happens to it. We know kind of what it symbolizes, or we can guess, because in the Old Testament, the fig tree is the symbol of people of Israel. All right, so so we kind of know what he's doing symbolically, but what's interesting is he goes back Tuesday, and as they're walking past it, because they're walking back from Bethany, and they pass that same fig tree, and the disciples say, it's gone. It's cursed. It's dead. And so it's a bit of a reminder of that, and a sort of fulfillment of it, that this actually has taken place just as Jesus said. And then the other thing that happens, which is kind of a long section in Matthew's gospel, is it goes from Matthew, the end of Matthew 21. To the beginning of Matthew 23, or through Matthew 23, is we get basically Jesus debating the scribes and the Pharisees, condemning woes against the scribes and the Pharisees. So woes against the scribes and the Pharisees at the end, and then. You know, this is where it's asked about the Olivet Discourse. This is where it's a little bit where it's kind of interesting and unclear about the timing, because he has this dialogue. He condemns them, and then it does say he leaves Jerusalem, goes to the Mount of Olives, speaks on the Mount of Olives to his disciples. But the timing of it is slightly unclear. We could be talking Tuesday. We could be talking later on, but nonetheless, this is primarily addressing the Jewish leaders in Jerusalem. And there, here are some of the things that you might remember from this. He tells this parable, for instance, of a wedding feast. And the parable of the wedding feast is, look, you know, all these people were invited, but none of them were ready when the invitation came, when the day actually came. And it's sort of a way in parable of saying to these people, you know, you're the ones who are invited, but when the day actually comes, you're not ready. And if you're not ready, then you're closed out of the feast itself. So that's Tuesday. It's we don't have tons of information about the back and forth and the timing of the back and forth, but there's a lot of teaching and interaction. Again, ramping up the conflict that began Monday with the cleansing of the temple. Okay. Stone that the builders rejected. I mean, that's where Jesus talks about all that. Now, this is where it's like I said, a little bit unclear. Because anyone want to tackle Wednesday? What happens Wednesday? Tuesday and Wednesday are the hardest days. All right, on Wednesday, again, out back, and then Jesus is teaching in the temple. Now, so Olivet Discourse, maybe now, maybe Tuesday, all right? And he's teaching at the temple, and as he's teaching at the temple, it specifically tells us that the chief priests, elders, and scribes plotted to kill Jesus. Matthew 26, Mark 14, Luke 22. So now it's gone beyond, like, we got to do something to, we've got to kill him. That's the only way to get through this. So that's a pretty big jump, right? We need to get past him, drive a wedge between him and the people, to let's come up with a plan to make sure to kill him. That's what it tells us happens Wednesday. And then, actually, something else very critical happens on Wednesday that goes along with that, which is Matthew, Mark, and Luke tell us Satan enters Judas's heart, and Judas decides to go to these chief priests who were already had already moved from we got to deal with it to we got to kill him. And Judas basically says, I'll help you, and I'll betray him for you. So now there's only one little piece of the puzzle remaining from the chief priest's perspective. They've got Judas. they know, they're all in agreement. They all want to kill him. Now it's just a question of how do we get the people and the legal mechanism to work in our favor so that we can put him to death. And that's going to, and that, so we're on Wednesday at this point. Okay. Thursday. Now maybe it's starting to get a little more familiar because now we actually get into parts that we're aware of. Anything you can think of that happens on Thursday? This is, think about it. I'll put it in language that might trigger you in a good way. On the night in which he was betrayed, or the night in which Jesus was going to be captured. So that's Thursday, right? What things do you know that happened Thursday?
The Passover?
Yeah. So this is, he celebrates the Passover meal. He says, all right, you've got the room. Now let's go to the room. And they go up to the room. They're going to celebrate the Passover meal. And Peter and John have secured this large upper room. It says, Matthew, Mark, Luke will say that. In the evening, he eats the Passover meal with the 12, tells them that he's going to be betrayed. This is the Last Supper. Tells them he's going to be betrayed. And then also institutes the Lord's Supper. So the institution of the Lord's Supper that we celebrate today, that's Thursday night, right before he's going to be betrayed, then crucified. So Thursday night, what else happens? After supper, he washes the disciples' feet. He interacts with them, delivers what in John, John alone records this for us. It's called the Upper Room Discourse, where Jesus gives all kinds of instruction to his disciples. And then John records this prayer that Jesus gives, which, again, this is all in John's gospel and not in the others, John 13 through 17. Then they sing a hymn at the end. We don't know exactly what it was. Probably Psalm 113 to 118. And then they go to the Mount of Olives. You guys have to leave early today?
Yeah,
oh, I didn't have the 45 minutes that I'm used to. Okay. Then after that, Jesus foretells that Peter's going to deny him before the rooster crows. So that night, Thursday night, into Friday morning, Peter, you're gonna deny me. All kinds of practical commands. Then they go to Gethsemane and he prays. So he's praying late Thursday night in the garden. That then brings us to early Friday morning, but it would have felt like Thursday night, right? Because this is after midnight, so we've tipped into Friday, but we're still in that same night. He's in Gethsemane, he's praying, they've had the Passover meal, and what happens then is Jesus is betrayed by Judas. So we're talking, who knows, 1 a.m., 2 a.m. in the morning. It's very, very early. In fact, the way it's described by the gospel writers, early Friday morning, but it's still dark. We get that in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, twice in John. Now, that then takes us into the trial phase. And this gets a little tricky because it happens on Friday pretty quickly, and it's completely irregular. It's not the way trials were supposed to be run, particularly on the Jewish side. On the Roman side, it's a little more normal, but still, you know, obviously unjust. But the Jewish side, it's just crazy. So Jesus stands trial but before Caiaphas and part of the Sanhedrin. Now, if the Temple Mount is like right here in Jerusalem, Caiaphas and the Sanhedrin all had homes kind of right here at the base of it. And so it's not far away. Gethsemane is on the other side of the wall over here, but again, not far away as the crow flies. You just walk in a gate. You're at the Temple Mount from the Mount of Olives. Then you go to the other side of the Temple Mount, and you're in the region where Caiaphas and all the wealthy Jewish leaders lived. So he has a trial before Caiaphas, but none of that should have happened. It shouldn't happen. It shouldn't happen during dark. Shouldn't happen on Passover. It's not a legitimate trial from a Jewish perspective, but they do it anyway because, really, since Monday they've wanted to do this, and since Tuesday they knew the outcome they wanted. And so Caiaphas' trial happens. Part of the Sanhedrin trial happens at the same time. So it's still dark, right? Again, 1, 2 a.m. This is happening. Peter also, we know, while this trial is going on, is kind of outside in a crowd. This is where he denies Jesus three times, it says. We get that in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And then probably right after this is when we have another trial that Jesus has, another appearance before the Sanhedrin, before the Jewish Sanhedrin. And it's and they basically say, let's send him to Pilate, who's the Roman governor. So they're done with him. They've pretty much decided, but it's so irregular, it's so strange, and then now they need the Romans to sign on to it because the Jewish leaders don't have the power to crucify anybody. They need the Romans to do that. And so they've kind of done their kangaroo court thing. But interestingly enough, in that last part of the trial, it says it wasn't just Caiaphas and a few members. It was a full Sanhedrin. So they're all there. All the Pharisees and Sadducees who made up the Sanhedrin say, yes, let's do this. Let's get him out of here. Even though it's Passover, let's send him to the Romans. So they send him to Pilate. This is all Friday. It happens very quickly. He's sent to Pilate. We read that this, again, just after sunrise, he's going off to Pilate. We also read that at this point, Judas kills himself. He goes outside the city. It was kind of the other side of the city from Gethsemane's here. He goes around to this other valley and kills himself there. He realizes what he's done. He sees the Sanhedrin had it out for Jesus, which he already knew. I mean, they paid him to betray Jesus. But he sees that happen, kills himself, hangs himself. And then he goes to Pilate. Then Pilate doesn't know what to do, sends him to Herod Antipas. Herod Antipas says, I want nothing to do with this, sends him back to Pilate. Remember, Pilate's wife wakes up in the morning. This is all happening very, very early. You know, it's sort of 6 a.m. type thing. And Pilate's wife says, I had a dream about him. I know you tried to send him to Herod Antipas, but don't have anything to do with him. But at this point, it's getting beyond Pilate's control, at least from his perspective. So this is now the Sanhedrin have basically gotten the crowds involved. And Pilate tries to broker this deal. Well, it's traditional for the Romans to release a Jewish prisoner. And the Jewish prisoner that I would suggest, Pilate says, is Barabbas, probably an insurrectionist, someone who tried to rally Jewish people against the Romans. Pilate says, how about him? And they say, Pilate says, how about Jesus instead of Barabbas? No, they say, we want Jesus crucified instead. And so Pilate washes his hands of it, but he's got, you see, Pilate's under tremendous political pressure because as soon as day breaks, it seems to him like all the Jewish people who are gathered in Jerusalem, this is a crowd control issue, this is a security issue, we might say, this is the biggest day where all the Jews are in the city. The city's run by the Romans, but the Jews overrun it during Passover. Pilate sees this thing blowing up, and so he just says, fine. You want, I don't think Jesus is worthy of death, but if that's who you want killed, that's who we'll kill. I'll release Barabbas to you. And so he then appears before Pilate. Pilate asks him these questions. Are you the king of the Jews? My kingdom is not of this world. That kind of stuff. Pilate says, all right, there's nothing I can do. You have to be. I'm going to hand you over to the Romans, and you're going to be killed. And then Jesus is crucified. And we're now on Friday, and it's about 9 a.m. So all that trial, all that stuff happens middle of the night, maybe 1 to 6, a lot of it, and then a couple hours in there where they just go back and forth. Because where Pilate lives and where Herod Antipas lives, none of this is far away. It's all very, very close proximity, and where the Sanhedrin are, it's a neighborhood away, but it's not far. And so 9 a.m., he's on the cross. And then we've got about 3 hours, which is actually, given the whole thing, pretty quick. Sometimes crucifixions could stretch on and on. One of the things that, you know this from the Gospels, one of the things that the Romans did was sometimes it takes someone a long time to die, because they ultimately died of asphyxiation, even though there's a lot of pain involved with nails and everything. It's ultimately they just can't prop themselves up and breathe. And so so then what they would do, if it just took hours and hours and hours, is they'd go by after about 3 or 4 hours and just take the hammer and break their shins, break their ankles. And so then they couldn't prop themselves up anymore, and their body would go into shock. But as you know, so Jesus dies fairly quickly because, as you know, they go to do that at about noon, and they realize he's dead already. And then this is where the soldier pierces the side of Jesus, and the blood and water come out. So from about, we're talking about 9 to 12, so noon. That morning, that Friday morning, is when this happens. Matthew 27, Mark 15, Luke 23, John 19. And then at the end of it all, what does the centurion is, it's very interesting as you think about it. You know, remember at the beginning of the week, who are the ones really seeking after Jesus? These Gentiles. And at the end, on Friday, who is it who's standing there who really seems to get it? Even though he's the one charged with the execution, he's got to carry it out. It's the centurion. And at the end, in Mark's gospel, and this is almost the very end of Mark's gospel, this centurion says, truly this was the Son of God. This man was the Son of God. And the centurion's eyes are opened, even though he has to, carry out orders and do this thing that even Pilate knew was wrong and Herod Antipas wanted nothing to do with. Although Herod Antipas recognized, we got to do something, or else the Jews are going to riot. And this was what he says at the end. And then of course we have these say 3 days. It's not 72 hours, but Jesus is put in the tomb on Friday. He's there Saturday, and then early Sunday morning, the first day of the week. We read about the women coming to the tomb. They don't see anything. They're just coming to check up and prepare the body and things like that. And the stone's rolled away. He's gone. And they go and, or I'm sorry, what happens is, first the empty tomb, then the women come and see him. They're the first ones to see him actually raised from the dead. And so those are the resurrection appearances that we were reminded of this morning. So, when you take the whole thing in its totality, some things rise to the surface, and this is the main thing I wanted to point out, in addition to getting a general chronology of the whole thing. What becomes clear is a number of things. First of all, that the people from a human perspective who are responsible in their own mind are responding to cultural pressures. The chief priests, the scribes, are concerned about the temple and the temple functioning properly during the Passover week. The Roman officials are concerned about Jewish uprising during the Passover week. All these people are responding to that kind of pressure. The other thing that's interesting is the very people you would expect based on the Old Testament. This is perhaps the most notable thing. The people you would expect based on the Old Testament to be most receptive to the Messiah coming into their midst would be people like the Jewish leaders. And they're actually the least receptive, the most antagonistic. The people that you would expect to have the least interest or the least ability to understand, like the centurion at the very end of the story, he's actually the one who gets it, or the Greeks at the beginning of the story. So this whole almost flipping on its head of expectations, who's actually supposed to understand, they don't, and the ones who aren't do. And it's a reminder, we need to wrap up, but it's a reminder that of what Paul says in 1 Corinthians 1. He says, we preach Christ crucified. And what does he say happens when we preach Christ crucified? I've determined to know nothing among you except Jesus Christ and him crucified. Well, the Jews are seeking signs. The Greeks are looking for wisdom. We preach Christ crucified. It's foolishness to all these people. But to us who are being saved, what do we see? That it's the power of God that's at work. And so... Paul even sees this dynamic, the dynamic that you see sort of played out during the week of Jesus leading to his crucifixion. That dynamic Paul says, is continually played out as the Gospels proclaim. That same pattern that people that shouldn't receive it do, and the people who you'd expect to don't. That dynamic of foolishness to the world, but it's really the wisdom of God on display, is powerfully presented here. Because it's not just who rejects and who accepts. If you look at it from the perspective of the Old Testament, even though your expectations about who accepts and rejects are inverted, at the same time, every aspect of it, and we didn't really even touch on this, but every aspect of it is a direct fulfillment of prophecy. So we see that, you know, God's wisdom is played out perfectly. And yet, from a human perspective, who receives and who doesn't is totally inverted, totally flipped on its head. All right, we're out of time, so let me just pray. Lord, thank you for the time that you have given us and for the many blessings that we enjoy from your word. And so, Father, as we come now into your presence, may we do so with joy and gladness in light of the resurrection of Jesus and all that entails for our faith. Be with us, we pray, in Jesus' name, amen.